From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, John Dominic Crossan, a former priest who is now one of the world's leading scholars of the historical Jesus. This is the study of the real person to whom the Gospels refer and an analysis of the culture, politics, and religion of his time. Crossan's new book is a historical analysis of the Apostle Paul and a revised interpretation of his writings. Also, we remember songwriter Cy Coleman. He died last week at age 75. He wrote the songs for the musicals Sweet Charity, I Love My Wife, and Little Me. His songs include Witchcraft, Hey Look Me Over, I've Got Your Number, and Big Spender. We'll listen back to an interview from the archive. And film critic David Edelstein reviews Alexander, directed by Oliver Stone. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Secretary of State Colin Powell called on Ukrainian officials today to disavow the results of an election that international observers say was tainted by fraud.
It is still not too late for Ukrainian authorities to find a solution that respects the will of the Ukrainian people. Countries around the world are watching the actions of Ukrainian leaders. We urge them to seize the moment.
Hundreds of thousands of Ukrainians rallied today to protest the election. Alex Klein reports from Kiev.
After the votes were counted,
Leonid Kuchma spoke with Colin Powell on the phone and told him the post-election situation in Ukraine should be resolved within the country's constitution. As Prime Minister Viktor Yanukovych was announced the winner in the runoff vote, more than 100,000 people rallied on Kiev's central square in a snowfall for a third day in a row, supporting the opposition candidate Viktor Yushchenko. As Yushchenko called for a nationwide strike, Yanukovych said he was ready for talks with the opposition. In the meantime, a growing number of city councils pledge allegiance to either Yushchenko or Yanukovych, while many military officers step up to say they won't fulfill orders directed against the people. For NPR News, I'm Alex Klemenov in Kiev.
Republican Dino Rossi has been declared the winner in the Washington governor's race, beating Democrat Christine Gregoire by a tiny fraction of the votes cast. NPR's Wendy Kaufman says it's the second narrow decision for Rossi.
After the votes were counted following the election, Dino Rossi had won the governor's race by 261 votes. Because the race was so close, state law required a machine recount. That was done. And when that recount was redone, 42 votes separated the two candidates. Now, the reason for that was there were some votes that were uncounted the first time that were counted the second time. There were some votes that were, quote, found that hadn't been counted the first time. But in the end, Chris Gregoire gained about 200 votes, but Dino Rossi still came up the winner by a margin once again of 42 votes out of 2.8 million ballots cast.
NPR's Wendy Kaufman in Seattle. The U.S. dollar fell to a new low against the euro today. Some positive economic news did little to arrest the currency's slide. NPR's Jim Zaroli reports.
The dollar fell to a 9-year low against the Swiss franc and a 4-year low against the Japanese yen. The U.S. currency has been on a downward slide for 2 years, but the decline has intensified in recent weeks because of investor concern about the growing U.S. trade and budget deficits. There's also been speculation that some central banks are considering reallocating some of their reserves into euros. Jim Zaroli, NPR News, New York.
In stocks today, the Dow gained 27 points to close at 10,520 in moderate trading. The Nasdaq was up 18 to close at 2102. This is NPR News. A Defense Department advisory panel has issued a report that says the U.S. invasions of Afghanistan and Iraq have increased anti-American feeling in the Muslim world. The Defense Science Board says U.S. actions have also increased the legitimacy of radical insurgents in the eyes of ordinary Muslims. The panel recommends that government policymakers should improve their understanding of public opinion around the world and that they should communicate U.S. policies more effectively to the rest of the world. The report is available on the Pentagon's website. It's one of the busiest travel days of the year, and thanks to a strike by toll booth operators, travel is free along the Pennsylvania Turnpike. Mark Newtbar has more from member station WDUQ.
About 2,000 Pennsylvania Turnpike toll collectors, maintenance workers, and office staff walked off the job at midnight last night after contract talks broke down. Toll gates were thrown open, allowing cars to pass without paying the toll. Starting at midnight tonight, management will take control of the toll booths to charge a flat $2 fee for cars. Commercial vehicles will pay $15 regardless of distance traveled. Turnpike spokesperson Bill Capone says it's up to the union to end this strike.
We're prepared to operate for as long as it takes. But at this point, no negotiating sessions have been scheduled.
Union members say management refused to meet with them last night in a last-ditch effort to come to an agreement. The union says it was told instead to simply accept the latest offer. That offer includes a pay structure that gives longtime toll takers more than $20 an hour. For NPR News, I'm Mark Neutbar in Pittsburgh.
Stock prices closed higher today on Wall Street. The S&P 500 gained 4 points to close at 1,181. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from National Geographic, publisher of the new 8th edition World Atlas with 17,000 updates on our constantly changing world, available wherever books are sold.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, John Dominic Crossan, is one of the world's leading scholars of the historical Jesus. This is the study of the real person to whom the Gospels refer and an analysis of the culture, politics, and religion of his time. This historical analysis is often controversial for challenging certain accounts in the Gospels as well as challenging commonly accepted interpretations. Crossan is a former priest. He left the monastery when he found himself unable to pursue the full extent of his convictions and historical research. Crossan is a professor emeritus of DePaul University. His books include The Historical Jesus, Jesus, a Revolutionary Biography, and Who Killed Jesus? His new book is called In Search of Paul, How Jesus' Apostle Opposed Rome's Empire with God's Kingdom. It offers a new interpretation of Paul's writings. Crossan describes Paul as the most dominant figure after Jesus in the New Testament. 13 of its 27 books are attributed to Paul, and about half of another is about him. Why did you want to re-examine Paul?
Because Paul has got a really bad press. It's a major question whether he is, as one of our chapters says, an appealing or an appalling apostle. And the reason is this, that there really are three different Pauls in the New Testament. A conservative Paul, a liberal Paul, and a radical Paul. And it depends upon whether a given letter was really originally, authentically written by Paul, or was attributed to him later. That's the issue, really.
When you say that Paul has gotten a bad rep, I think one of the things you're probably talking about is what he said about women. Why don't you quote some, one or two of his most famous passages about
infamous
the submissive role of women?
Let me use the gender controversy as a way of discriminating the three Pauls. The conservative Paul is usually what everyone knows from 1 Timothy, where he says that women are to be at home and they're not supposed to be teaching men in church, which, by the way, tells us, of course, that they were. You wouldn't have to forbid something that wasn't happening. But in 1 Timothy, women are not to be teaching men in church. They're to be at home. They're to be pregnant. They're to be silent if they have questions, ask their husband. Nice and clear. That's the conservative Paul. In 1 Timothy, which was not written by Paul. The liberal Paul would appear, say, in Ephesians and Colossians, also not written by Paul, where he says that women should obey their husbands, but then spends a lot more time telling husbands that they should sacrifice themselves for their wives, something that tends to get forgotten. I call that the liberal Paul. The radical Paul is the one, say, in Corinthians or in Romans, who insists that women are equal to men in the family, in the community, that's the church, in the apostolate. The Paul, for example, who sends the epistle to the Romans, his most important epistle, with a woman. And of course, she's going to have to then read the epistle, explain the epistle to the communities at Rome. This is the radical Paul, who simply says that in Christ Jesus, there is neither male nor female, slave nor free, Jew nor Gentile, in Christ Jesus.
Well, your new book, In Search of Paul, is co-written with an archaeologist. And is there like archaeological information that helps you determine which of these three Pauls you think is the more authentic?
What we are really doing in archaeology is looking for the archaeology of Paul's theological world, not just his social world. But for example, all over the Roman Empire, in archaeological digs that you can find, you can't miss them, in coins, in inscriptions, in images, in structures, you're getting a message that Caesar is divine, son of God, God, God from God, Lord, Savior of the world, Redeemer, Liberator, all of that stuff is there. So when Paul walks into Ephesus, for example, he walks under a gate that says that the Imperator Caesar is the son of God. Now, when he talks to his people in Ephesus about Jesus being the Son of God, that is known technically as high treason. So it's precisely the archaeology of Roman imperial theology that makes so much importance for Paul, rather than, well, we know he was in Ephesus, here's what Ephesus looked like in the first century.
Let me quote something from your new book about Paul. You write, "What is newest about this book is our insistence that Paul opposed Rome not because the empire was particularly unjust or oppressive, but because he questioned the normalcy of civilization itself, since civilization has always been imperial, that is, unjust and oppressive." Could you explain that?
Yes, it's an invention. Civilization is an invention, and it has always been imperial. From the first time the Akkadians went roaring down the Mesopotamian plains, and isn't it ironic? You know, it starts in the Mesopotamian plains where we are today. Empire has been the normalcy of civilization. We tend to think, well, civilization is about music and art and literature and all that magnificent stuff, which it is, of course, very often on the back, of course, of an empire, sometimes at its most fruitful times. So if civilization has always been imperial, then Paul is not against Rome because he wants, say, a Jewish empire or an Irish empire, maybe. It's because there's something wrong with civilization, not with human nature, but with civilization. It always goes imperial, which means unjust. And his language, say, of a new creation, I don't find even, you know, hyperbolic. It's like we're going to have to go back and start all over again because our, using my metaphor, our drug of choice in civilization has been violence, and we're now getting to the point where the withdrawal or the continuation are about equally awful. So Paul is really challenging civilization on its basis. Why is it always imperial, he wants to know.
What did Paul do that was most challenging of the Roman Empire?
What Paul is doing is really setting up, I would almost say, an alternative empire, because he is not just sitting down in one place. He's moving around the whole Mediterranean, and what he is doing is setting up small little cells, as it were, in the major cities. If you watch what he does, he goes straight for the capitals. He's in Thessalonica, capital of Macedonia. He's in Corinth, capital of Achaia. He's in Ephesus, capital of Asia. And he grows up in Tarsus, capital of Cilicia. He's a man of capitals, and his strategy is to go to the capital, set up your little cells of an alternative lifestyle. They'll go out to the other cities, and maybe they'll get to the countryside eventually. And his method of doing it is setting up these tiny Christian, he calls them assemblies. We translate them as churches, which throws us off. They're really, the Greek word is ecclesia, which is the word for the at least male members of the city when they come together to decide the city's destiny and fate. And I imagine him in the shops. I think that's where he would meet, not in the villas or not in the houses or the tenements, but in those shops you can still see all over Roman cities. They're maybe 10 feet by 10 feet. And people coming in and out is not going to draw any attention to themselves. Small little groups, 10, 15, we're not talking huge, but there might be 3, 4, 5 in any given city. There's certainly 6 or 7 in Rome alone. But they're all over the place. It's not so much whether they are 1,000 Christians by the year 50, but whether there's 10 in 100 cities.
Paul believed that the end of days was near and that the second coming would happen in his lifetime. How did that affect his view of the Roman Empire and what should be done about it and his view of what the righteous life was?
And by the way, thank you, Terry, for saying the end of days, because sometimes what people say is the end of the world. And in the first century, Jews and Christians never imagined the end of the world because only God could destroy creation. And God would never do that since God had created it and said it was all good. We can imagine the end of the world because we can do it, unfortunately. So what Paul is claiming, like Jesus before him, is that this great period of what he calls justification, meaning making the world a just place. It's a very simple, everyday word. It sounds strange to us, but justification. Augustus would probably say, oh, that's what I'm doing. Yep, I'm making the world just. So Paul talks about justification. And what he is declaring is that the end of days when God would make the world just has already commenced. Now, you're also quite right in saying that he tells us, and don't worry, it'll be over soon. Because any radical mutation in thinking, we always want to say, well, it's not that great a radical. It's just a minor thing. Now, he was wrong on that. And my advice is simply get over it. The more important thing, though, is he was insisting that it has begun and God is calling us to participate with God in the process, rather than us waiting for God, as it were. It's a dialectical process between God and us. Nobody's waiting on the other. This has to be done together, not us without God, not God without us. Otherwise, it would be impossible to explain why Christianity didn't dribble out after about two generations in acute disappointment. But he was simply wrong about the minor point. Now, if you want to say, well, the second coming is still off in the future, and when he said soon, that means today, well, good luck. I would simply say anyone who has talked about the future, let me speak within Christianity, has been wrong. It might be time to begin to wonder, is our assertion about the second coming our refusal to accept the first one? And is this idea of a non-violent Jesus just something we can't handle? So we want Jesus to come back and do it right. Come back and get it right. Come back violently, in plain language. So the real question about the second coming is, do we or do we not believe in a violent God? And did Jesus and Paul proclaim or did they not proclaim a violent God?
Now, I should say, listeners who are listening to us might be thinking, have they changed format? Is this a religious show now? Because we're talking, I mean, we're literally talking chapter and verse here.
Right.
So I'm wondering, for anybody who isn't Christian who's listening and who isn't interested in studying Paul because it tells them more about their religion, what historical significance does your book about Paul have, and what relevance does it have for people today who are not necessarily followers of Christianity?
Well, we've just gone through an election in which the conservative right in this country assumed a monopoly on Christianity, on moral values, on biblical traditions, and probably at least indirectly on Jesus and Paul. What this book does, as the earlier book Excavating Jesus does, is insist that there is another vision of Christianity and of the Bible and of moral values, which is equally Christian. And I'd even go on to say that 4 years from now, if the Democrats want to be able to meet the Republicans on an even field, they better do some theology. And they better learn to put their theological language in public discourse. For example, I can talk about Jesus and Paul, or I can talk using Christian language and all the rest of it. I could use Paul's Greek term dikaiosune, justification and righteousness, or I could translate that into global justice, which is what it is, by the way. I'm not just, you know, flipping it. Paul is asking, how is this world, the world, he would say God's world, but let me say the world, to be maintained justly, and justly simply means that everyone gets a fair shake at it. That is public language. It actually is the language, since I am in Philadelphia, of all people being created equal and endowed by the Creator with certain inalienable rights, among which are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. That's not what Paul is saying, but that's the way we said it. So this is actually transcendental language. You make a claim that all, let me say all people, are created equal. That's an imperial claim almost. It's a transcendental claim. It is, in plain language, a theological claim. And if the T word, theology, is a dirty word for some people, then they better at least learn how to oppose it with public discourse language.
My guest is John Dominic Crossan. He's a scholar of the historical Jesus. His new book is called In Search of Paul. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is John Dominic Crossan, a scholar of the historical Jesus. He's professor emeritus of religion at DePaul University. Crossan's new book is called In Search of Paul. It examines the life and writings of the Apostle Paul. I want to get back to the fact that Paul believed that he would witness the second coming of Christ in his own lifetime, and that the end of days was near. Many Christians believe that today, that the second coming is imminent, they will witness the end of days, and there's a vision of the end of days that says that those who have been born again will rise to heaven, and everybody else will be left behind on earth to face the tribulations. And this is a vision that is, among other things, described in a very popular series of novels called the Left Behind series that's co-authored by Tim LaHaye, who was one of the founders of the Moral Majority and who is one of the leaders of the new group that was just founded by Jerry Falwell, which is kind of like a new vision of the Moral Majority. So do you think that today's vision of the Second Coming is affecting either culture in America or politics in America?
Yes, I do. I think it's infecting it, not just affecting it, but it's infecting it with a sort of a culture of violence, first of all, because it says, in effect, that God's final solution to the problem of evil is to kill the evildoer, rather massively. The rider on the white horse in the apocalypse is going to have blood up to the bridles for 200 miles, which is a pretty ghastly scenario. And I think it does infect us in general, but it also infects us in particular, that when it was communism against capitalism, as it were, and both had the atomic bombs, and they held one at bay because we sort of could trust that nobody would do anything really stupid. If I imagine religious fundamentalism of any sort, but we're talking for the moment about Christian fundamentalism, which has atomic power. I don't mean it's going to go out and destroy the world someday, but it could do this, which leads to that, which leads to this, which leads to that, and at that point we have no alternative, let's say, but use the atomic bomb. It could have a certain carelessness about the faith of the world, since it presumes that it and people like it are going off to heaven, to a better place, and that maybe God is consigning the world to hell, as it were.
Do you think that the center of mainstream Christianity has shifted?
I think what has happened is the center has grown flaccid, weak, uncertain of its message, can give you a whole list of things it doesn't believe in or you don't have to believe in or that are in the Bible but you don't have to follow, many of which are quite correct, by the way. But it hasn't a positive message. A lot of the positive message, the message of a Jesus or a Paul, I find myself being told, well, you're just talking politics. And I say, no, I'm talking at the point where politics and religion cannot be separated, maybe distinguished, but cannot be separated. I'm talking at the same level that Paul, looking at a silver denarius that said Caesar was the son of God, couldn't say, well, now Caesar is political, but son of God, that's religious. I think at the deep level, you cannot separate religion and politics because we cannot separate body and soul at a deep level.
I think I've asked you this before on Fresh Air, but do you practice religion anymore?
I may have answered the same way, that I would have to say I don't know the difference between prayer and study. This is what I think about all the time. This is the default condition of my mind. I don't mean I can't do all sorts of other things. I don't. But if I'm out jogging, for example, this is what I'm thinking about. Not because I think I should, because I don't know how not to. I don't consider that practicing religion means whether you go to church on Sunday. That's one way of doing it. And sometimes that is 1 hour a week. I've spent most of my time in the last 30 years trying to live with Jesus and to walk like Jesus, and a lot of time to walk where Jesus walked and where Paul walked. I think that's what it means to be a Christian. It's not a statement that you can be a Christian by not going to church. It's not a statement that you can be a Christian by going to church. It is a question of what's on your mind most of the time. What are you thinking about most of the time?
Do you pray?
Yes. But for many people, I noticed that prayer is sort of asking God for stuff. I try to bring my whole life into the presence of God. And what I take very seriously is how the human will gets in some kind of unity with God without deluding itself. A very simple thing. As a scholar, I have to read all sorts of people telling me how wrong I am. I can't simply say, well, you're all wrong back, because I have to, in public very often, comment. So my own will is constantly being challenged. I don't know how people who say, well, I've prayed over it and I've decided, I don't know how they have not simply certified their own will as the will of God.
So prayer or religion for you isn't about self-affirmation or about giving you more of a sense of certainty?
No, and I have been asked, well, don't you have doubts? Well, first of all, you have to have certainty in order to have doubts. And I consider that this is in the title of the book, In Search of Paul, it's a search. It's an ongoing search. Now, I'm quite willing to say this is what I think we have found, and this is what we're trying to live by, so it's not just all in the future. But it's an ongoing process, so certainty doesn't come up. Trust comes up, faith comes up, hope comes up, and charity comes up, as it were. But certainty, I don't find that term too often in the Bible, except in the sense of trust, in the sense of intellectual certainty, like 2 and 2 is 4 or something. That doesn't seem to be a concern of the Bible. What is very much, can you trust this God? Yes. Could you love this God with all your heart and all your soul and all your strength and all your mind? Yes. Could I trust Jesus? Yes. Do I trust Paul? Yes. But that's an act of faith. It's not simply, it's an intellectual proposition and I find it rather interesting. No, it's a commitment of life. It's not simply a set of propositions that you find that you approve of. It's a challenge of life that I find I can barely live up to, but I think it is right.
John Dominic Crossan, thanks for talking with us again on Fresh Air.
It is, Terry, as always, a great pleasure and an honor.
John Dominic Crossan is Professor Emeritus of Religion at DePaul University. His new book is called In Search of Paul. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by the Alzheimer's Association, encouraging Americans to learn about ways to reduce the risk of Alzheimer's disease on the web at alz.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we remember songwriter Cy Coleman. He died last week at the age of 75. His best-known songs include Witchcraft, I've Got Your Number, Hey Look Me Over, and If My Friends Could See Me Now, which is from his musical Sweet Charity. Also, David Edelstein reviews the new movie Alexander. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The songwriter Cy Coleman died of heart failure last week at the age of 75. Some of his songs include Witchcraft, The Best Is Yet to Come, I've Got Your Number, Hey Look Me Over, Big Spender, and If My Friends Could See Me Now. Many of his best-known songs were written for Broadway shows like I Love My Wife, Little Me, and Sweet Charity. A revival of Sweet Charity is scheduled to open on Broadway in April, starring Christina Applegate, who played the daughter on Married with Children. Let's hear a song Coleman wrote early in his career with lyricist Carolyn Lee. Here's Frank Sinatra.
Out of the tree of life, I just picked me a plum. You came along and everything started in to hum. Still, it's a real good bet, the best is yet to come. Best is yet to come, and babe, won't that be fine? You think you've seen the sun, but you ain't seen it shine. Wait till the warm-up's underway. Wait till our lips have met. And wait till you see that sunshine day. You ain't seen nothing yet. The best is yet to come, and babe, won't it be fine? Best is yet to come, come the day you're mine.
The Best Is Yet to Come, recorded in 1964. When I spoke with Cy Coleman in 1985, he told me that his first big break came with the song Why Try to Change Me Now, which Frank Sinatra recorded after listening to a demo tape Coleman sent him.
The way things were done in those days is that you'd write a song, you'd take it to a publisher, then you'd go make a demo record, and the demo would be sent to either Sinatra's manager or Sinatra's representative, or if you were lucky enough to have the address, to Sinatra himself. I used to do my own demos. I used to enjoy doing my own demos. I think that's how I got to sing more and more, you know, because I never used to get my nose up out of the piano. I started off as a pianist, you know, so most pianists don't like to look up. And as I did my own songs, I started to look up more and more, and I started to sing my songs, and I started to develop a way of doing them and learning what songs are about and the presentation of songs.
Gee, it's nice to think that you know, Frank Sinatra heard you singing your songs and said, yeah, I'll do that one too.
Yes, exactly.
Did you ever write songs with him or Bennett in mind?
No. My approach to writing is writing from your own emotional experience, or else the experience of collaboration. So I can't say that I ever wrote for a pop artist with a song in mind. You know, I've ever wrote for Tony Bennett or Peggy Lee or Frank Sinatra, although I was delighted when they did my songs, naturally. But I think when you write a song, you have to be true to the song itself. I mean, you have to be true to the concept of what you're going to do. You have to be true to what you're saying. It has to have an emotional honesty.
I want to play the Frank Sinatra recording of your song, Witchcraft, which has a lyric by Carolyn Lee. In the tradition of there's a story behind every song, does this song have a story?
Well, no, it had a title, and that was, as a matter of fact, and Carolyn Lee had the title. And she said, let's, you know, she loved the title. And so I sat down and started fooling around with it. The first song, the tune I wrote for it, we decided wasn't any good because I wrote a very kind of exotic voodoo type of song. I was right on the nose with it, you know, saying witchcraft and ooh, you know, that sort of thing. And then when I got the opening phrase for it, you know what I mean? The dun, 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 dun. Well, I started to build from there. That was an interesting phrase. And when I got to the end of the phrase, Carolyn popped in, that's witchcraft. You see, and it went from there. It just continued to grow. I had an interesting story about that. I had some very nice compliments on that song. Not very nice compliments, miraculous compliments. The one was from Richard Rodgers, who told me he particularly loved the song. And then the other one was from Duke Ellington, who I didn't know either of them. And Duke Ellington said he admired the form of the song because I had broken a new barrier unbeknownst to myself. I wasn't attempting to create a new form.
What was the barrier that you broke?
The AABA song and the ABAB. And it wasn't a barrier. I mean, there had been songs that are written like that. But what I did was I kind of wrote a strange kind of thing. I went to A. Then I went to a form of A. It was kind of almost a variation of A. Then you'd have to call it B. If you were to call that B, the variation B, then you'd have to call the next part C. Then I went to another variation of A before I returned to A. I mean, that sounds very complicated, but in the doing of it, it all sounds very natural. It came out naturally. I didn't contrive it.
Well, let's hear Frank Sinatra's recording of your song, Witchcraft, and my guest is composer Cy Coleman.
Are those fingers in my hair, that sly come hither stare, strips my conscience bare, it's witchcraft. And I've got no defense for it, that heat is too intense for it. What good would common sense for it do? 'Cause it's witchcraft, wicked witchcraft. And although I know it's strictly taboo, when you rouse the need in me, my heart says yes indeed in me. Proceed with what you're leading me to. It's such an ancient pitch, but one that I'd never switch. There ain't no nicer witch than you. It's witchcraft, that cuckoo witchcraft. And although I know it's strictly taboo, when you arouse the need in me, my heart says yes indeed in me. Proceed with what you're leading me to. It is such an ancient pitch, but one that I'd never switch, 'cause there's no nicer witch than you, than you, than you. Oh, you're a fine witch.
That's Frank Sinatra singing Witchcraft, composed by my guest, Cy Coleman. How do you feel when Sinatra takes your song and does that cuckoo witchcraft?
Well, I accept the fact that it's Sinatra. When you get Sinatra, you get all the personality, and you get the things that Sinatra does with the song. And when Sinatra sings a song so beautifully and so well that the rest of it all goes with it.
Okay.
I must tell you this, that in one case, and this is not a message to other people who may sing my songs, but... And why try to change me now? In singing the phrase, he changed one note. And I think it was inadvertent. I don't think he meant to. It just flew. He went the way it was natural. And I listened to it. And I listened to it for about 6 months. And I said, you know, he's right. Hmm. And I changed the song.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
That's interesting.
I don't do that very often. In fact, that was the only time I ever did that. But it was just a more natural flow of the line itself.
We're listening to a 1985 interview I recorded with Cy Coleman. He died last week at the age of 75. We'll hear more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Thank you. Let's get back to the 1985 interview I recorded with Cy Coleman. He died last week at the age of 75. Here's one of the songs he wrote for Sweet Charity, Big Spender. The lyric is by Dorothy Fields.
You walked in the joint, I could see you were a man of distinction, a real big spender, good looking, so refined. Say, wouldn't you like to know what's going on in my mind? So let me get right to the point. I don't pop my cork for every guy I see. Hey, big spender! Spend a little time with me. About a few laughs, I can show you a good time. Do you wanna have fun, fun, fun?
How's about a few
fun laughs, fun laughs, fun laughs?
I can show you a
fun
laughs, good time,
fun
laughs, good time.
In the 1950s, you were best known as a songwriter, but beginning in 1960, you really switched to writing scores for Broadway. Why did you go that route? Why did you go to Broadway instead of keeping up writing individual songs?
Well, actually, I just, you know, it was like, to put it, you know, in a very kind of strange way, I was so more like Alice in Wonderland. They didn't know I was a songwriter when I was doing that. My actual reputation was with a jazz trio in the 50s, and I was writing songs on the side. And while I did some things, I contributed some songs, but it was kind of my secondary career, writing songs. And because I had the hit, there was a publisher who came to me, another publisher, and he offered me a deal, and I had my own club at the time. That was my own jazz club. And he offered me this deal where he would give me a certain amount of money each week, and I would just write, and he would publish it. And it was with Carolyn Lee. So we wrote, and then we got an agent, and then we started auditioning for Broadway shows. In the meantime, I must tell you, I still thought that this was a secondary aspect of my life. I was had a very interesting career going. I was on television all the time. I was making records. I was playing clubs and quite content with it and very, very nervous about this encroaching career coming upon me.
Did you find someone to be like a mentor to you or a tutor in the ways of Broadway?
Quite to the contrary. I found nothing but tormentors.
what particularly did they do?
Well, you know, it's a very competitive area, and you discover that as you go along, you know what I mean? And then, you know, when you get into a show, and it's a collaborative process, it's something you must learn. You know, when you're young and you start off with a show, to me, when I did the first show, I thought, my music is the most important thing in this show, obviously, and it will save whatever's here. Now, everybody feels this thing, from the scenic designer, who feels, why do they have this music in my way? I mean, if they can just let these sets and light them properly, and we have the costume, which is the same thing. As a matter of fact, in the 13 Days to Broadway, my show at Russell Baker, we had a song that I cut. It was called For the Good of the Show, where everybody gets up and says, you know, if they'd only get out of my way, I'm only doing this for the good of the show. There's no personal ego involved here. And that's what that is. What you learn is, you know, that it is a collaborative medium. And it is the kind of thing that where you have to figure out the end result and the product. And that's what really is important.
So do you believe in that theater homily that in a good show the audience walks out singing one of the songs?
I don't think that's true at all. I think that if you pound them to death with the same melody, they're going to walk out singing the song.
Well, that's a good trick, though, isn't it? You keep having reprises of the song, and then they will walk out singing it.
Yeah, but I mean, there's something wrong with the whole idea of people considering themselves, including critics, theater mavens, a musical maven. I'm a musician. I'm a musician all my life, and I'd be hard put to go walking out to say what the hit song was out of a show or start singing one. And I don't think we should look for that. What we should look for in a show is does it serve it? Is it dramatically? Is it right? And then worry about whether it's a hit song later. Usually, you know, we used to get a lot of records on songs before that. In this rock and roll era, you know, punk music, everything that's different, we don't get theater music recorded the same way. We don't have the Sinatras and the Peggy Lees and the Barbara Streisands doing our theater music. As a result of that, they don't walk in or out humming the song. Eventually, if somebody makes a record of it, that's how you hear the songs, and that's how most people used to hear them. You know, and that's the only thing you'd be afraid of is people walking in, you know, humming the songs before they heard them.
You collaborated with Dorothy Fields for, I'm thinking specifically of Sweet Charity here. I think she's just one of the greatest American lyricists. How did you have to bring her out of retirement to write with you? Because she'd been writing songs back in the 1920s.
Well, you know, it was funny. You know, I was at a songwriters meeting. Sheldon Harnick had a meeting. And I saw her there. And I just went over to her and I said to her, you know, I'd like to write with you. Would you like to? She said, well, I'm so happy you asked. She said, nobody asks me. And we worked together, and it turned out to be a very successful collaboration.
I want to play one of the songs that you wrote together for the show Sweet Charity.
Uh-huh.
And we're going to hear Gwen Verdon singing If My Friends Could See Me Now. This is a really terrific song. Can you talk a little bit about writing this?
Well, sure. It came right out of the script. We had Charity was up in this movie star's apartment. And she was just that kind of girl. She was just so flabbergasted to be there that, I mean, all she could think of was, this is the most of her friends at the ballroom, telling them what this fantastic Italian movie star's apartment. And all she wanted was an autographed picture. I mean, so that was the naive girl we're talking about. And so she asked him for an autographed picture, and he goes out, and she says, oh, if the girls at the ballroom could see me now. And she says, if my friends could see me now. So then, aside from that, she does some dances that Bob Fosse did, which, of course, are wonderful. You know, there's nothing that he does that isn't wonderful. And she sings. The first chorus is a general chorus of If My Friends Could See Me Now, which is kind of like it doesn't relate to things that happen. Then the next chorus is If They Could See Me Now Alone with Mr. V, who's waiting on me like he was a maitre d'. I'd hear those gift shop cats say, brother, get her, draped on a bedspread made of three kinds of fur. And we had three kinds of fur. It specifically relates in the other choruses to things that are happening within the show. And we keep building on that. It's a short chorus, If My Friends Could See Me Now. And I didn't know it was going to be the kind of hit song that it turned out to be. It turned out to be a monster hit song. And you know, and sung in various versions. I didn't know so because it was such a short chorus. I didn't know. But, you know, if they like it, you know, they're going to find ways to do it.
If they could see me now, that little gang of mine, I'm eating fancy chow and drinking fancy wine. I'd like those Stumbo bums to see for a fact the kind of top drawer, first rate chums I attract. All I can say is, wow, we look at where I am. Tonight I landed, pow, right in a pot of jam. What a setup, holy cow. They'd never believe it if my friends could see me now.
Our interview with Cy Coleman was recorded in 1985. He died of heart failure last week at the age of 75. His show Sweet Charity will be revived on Broadway in the spring. Coming up, film critic David Edelstein reviews Alexander. This is Fresh Air. Thank you.
From 336 BC until his death in 323 BC, Alexander the Great believed he had a mandate to become the ruler of the world, to be even greater than the greatest Greek gods. Now his life is the subject of a new movie by Oliver Stone. It stars Colin Farrell as Alexander and Angelina Jolie as his equally intense mother. David Edelstein has this review.
Alexander has done something I never thought possible. It has made me feel sympathy for Oliver Stone. The movie is a mess, a botch, a non-event, but it's not like Stone's other bad movies, which are overinflated. This one seems almost too puny and fragmented for its great subject. It feels as if Stone, for the first time, ran out of hot air. You have to understand, I consider Stone's Natural Born Killers to be hands down the worst movie ever made, and not the worst like Ed Wood's Plan 9 from Outer Space. I mean the worst in its combination of aesthetic and moral ugliness, in the way it bombards you into accepting the idea that a pair of serial mass murderers could be enlightened hipsters and even existential heroes. Now, Stone attempts to tell the story of another mass murderer and existential hero, Alexander the Great, the young Macedonian king who swept through Greece and then the Persian Empire, what is now Egypt, Syria, Iran, and Iraq, and then into India, a dozen years of conquests that at the very least touch the lives of more people on the planet than any military leader before him. How does Stone feel about this man, played by Colin Farrell? Guardedly positive. Yes, there are all those people he massacred, but isn't that a small price to pay for greatness? And if his men didn't always see the logic of his dream to spread Hellenic civilization and unite the world, maybe that's because they weren't fellow eagles. They couldn't see nation-state borders as illusions, as he did, soaring above them. If Stone is ambivalent about the man, he is certain that, as his narrator puts it, his failures dwarfed other men's successes. That narrator is Anthony Hopkins, as the aged General Ptolemy. He's dictating his memoirs for posterity, and he can't quite get a handle on how to tell Alexander's story. Neither, for that matter, can Stone and his co-screenwriters. There's a huge leap from the young Alexander having a public fight with his drunken one-eyed father, Philip, played by Val Kilmer, to Alexander leading 40,000 men against 250,000 Persians at the Battle of Gaugamela. Late in the movie, Stone doubles back and fills in some of the gaps, but by then, the dire storytelling and tin-eared dialogue have dulled our curiosity. Much is made of Alexander's tactical genius in overcoming long odds, but despite the eagle-eye views, I mean literally, Alexander has this bond with a ubiquitous bird of prey. It's impossible to tell where any army is in relation to any other army. Alexander is packed with kinetic images, but the editors must have had a stroke trying to make them flow together. Listening to Alexander appeal to his exhausted army, which sensibly thinks he has gone too far instead of consolidating power in the lands he already holds, you find yourself fearing most for Colin Farrell's vocal cords.
You're right, Craterus. I have been negligent. I should have sent you veterans home sooner, and I will. The first of you shall be the Silver Shields. And then every man who served 7 years. And respected, rich, loved. You'll be treated by your wives and children as heroes for the rest of your lives. And enjoy a peaceful death. But you dream, Craterus. Your simplicity long ended when you took Persian mistresses and children, and you thickened your holdings with plunder and jewels. Because you've fallen in love with all the things in life that destroy men. Do you not see? And you, as well as I, know that as the years decline and the memories stale and all your great victories fade, it will always be remembered. You left your king in Asia!
Farrell had a good, handsome bully boy presence in Daredevil and in a terrific Irish movie called Intermission. He's likably small scale. You can imagine him firing up the lads at the pub before he gets too stuporous. But all the armies of the Western world? He doesn't begin to have the stature or the lung power. And the poofy blonde locks don't help. Quite a bit has been written about the acknowledgement here of Alexander's bisexuality, but it's tame stuff. Moist looks, mostly, traded with Jared Leto, an actor with bright blue eyes who's too self-intoxicated to be much of an erotic force. Despite a part that has no dramatic arc, Val Kilmer blusters through in entertaining style. But the only real heroic presence is Angelina Jolie, improbably cast as Alexander's imperious mother, Olympias. I don't care how nuts she is. Jolie is the real deal, an actress who can commit herself body and soul to a part and transform from the inside out. She could eat Colin Farrell for breakfast and pick her teeth with Jared Leto. Forget Alexander. This is Angelina the Great.
David Edelstein is film critic for the online magazine Slate. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Patty Leswing, Ian Chillog, and Sam Brigger. All of us at Fresh Air wish you a happy Thanksgiving. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, publishers of Mark Summers' new illustrated edition of Poems and Tales by Edgar Allan Poe, available at Barnes & Noble stores and online at bn.com. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, by Arista Records, Sarah McLachlan and her new CD and DVD set, Afterglow Live, features a new live concert and her latest video at all FYE locations. And from Alfred A. Knopf, publisher of His Excellency George Washington by Joseph J. Ellis, author of Founding Brothers. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On our Thanksgiving Day edition of Fresh Air, the life and music of a great American songwriter, Johnny Mercer. He wrote the lyrics for such classics as Come Rain or Come Shine, Moon River, and Blues in the Night. We'll hear from his biographer, Philip Furia. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.